Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Visit one of our 44 stores across Ireland for quality curtains and bedding at great prices. Find your perfect style today.
Mark Dunlop. Mark, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
I'm so sorry to meet you under these circumstances, Mark, because you were the manager, not just a manager, a close friend and mentor to John Cooney, the Galway-born fighter who was fighting on the 1st of February, only, 10 days ago, and he was defending his super featherweight championship title, this called the Celtic title. He suffered an intracranial hemorrhage. And will you tell us about the night, and when did you realise, Mark, that what had befallen John was extraordinarily serious?
Yes, well, basically, obviously, it was a fantastic night in terms of like the stable and for John, because John was getting the opportunity to box live on terrestrial television. He would have been the first contest that the BBC had shown and live terrestrial television in over 15 years.
Okay.
So it was a very, very big night, and John was well up for the challenge. He was in the shape of his life, and his coach Stephen O'Rourke had done a brilliant job getting him there, and in shape and ready to go for this opportunity. Sadly, John came out, won the first round easily. We thought it was all going to be over. To be honest, we've had another 10 seconds. John would have actually defeated Hiles in the first round, but as it happens, just the way John had him all like rocked all over the place, and as what happened was obviously the bell went and saved the other kid. Just then things started to not go right for John. He started to fall behind slightly in the contest. His coach tried to gee him up a couple of times, and he just fell back in terms of like behind in the fight, and the referee stopped the contest. John was failed by a body shot. I think it was the 9th round, and he got up and it seemed more exhaustion than the hurt from the body shot. But he was then given immediate care by Dr. Martin Duffy, who's the head of the chief medical officer of the British Boxing Board of Control in Belfast, and him and his team assessed John and decided to take him to the Royal Victoria Hospital, Belfast, which for precautionary measures of anything, I've involved in boxing 40 years. I've never seen anything like it, to be honest with you. And you never think it's going to come to your door, but unfortunately this night it did. And obviously we were doing a show. I thought, I'd never even give it a second thought that John would be seriously hurt. I thought he was just taken for a precautionary measure, but you know, so whenever the show finished then at 11 o'clock, I went straight up there. And by this point, John was on the operating theatre for obviously to release the pressure from a bleed on his brain. And never recovered, unfortunately. And his whole family, his dad Hugh, his mum Tina, his fiancée Emmeline, they all had a vigil by his bedside, and all his extended family for the whole week. And then John passed away on Saturday evening, and to the devastation of us all and the boxing world.
And you were there a lot of the time, Mark. Was there ever any glimmer of hope?
There was about the Tuesday. They had started to take John off the medication, you know, if there was any activity. And whenever I arrived the next morning at the hospital, there was a feeling of hope, you know, and basically John had moved a couple of times. He had shown some sort of movement, which then, because at that point, prior to that, you know, they'd said like it wasn't looking good for John. So we all had that hope, and we were all praying, you know, that he would show us something. And that morning, I went in with John for a while on my own, and And I was praying, on my knees praying, you know, as they say. Yeah. It was an extended family member to me. So what happened was then he moved his arm a couple of times. I told the nurse, she came in, yeah, checked. And then as I was leaving, I'd said to John, I said, Lord, show me something. Show me something. And he coughed a little bit. So again, obviously, mm-hmm, I told the family, they went back in then and it moved a few times. But then the next sort of day, nothing really transpired off it. And as I say, that was they were always praying for a miracle after that point. Yeah. But unfortunately, it was John's time.
And when did you first, he's a very young man, 28. When did you first meet John, Mark?
So I'm the manager of Eric Donovan also, who's obviously well known to yourselves. He's part of your
yeah,
team.
Yeah.
And Eric was sparring John in O'Rourke's gym in Dublin. And I drove down to Belfast to watch it and catch up with Eric. And he was sparring John that day. And it was a fantastic spar. And I remember, you know, coming from driving back home thinking, wow, that kid's very good. Yeah. You know, and I wouldn't have ever had the opportunity, I would sign him. And I was talking to Eric about him, and Eric swore by him, thought he was fantastic and had everything, charisma, you know, was happy to sell himself, you know, and he feared nobody. So he's a manager and promoter's dream. So that's what happened. Then joined the stable. And he was with us for 4 years.
And would he have stayed? I know it's you're away from home. Would he have stayed with you, Mark? Would he have stayed with your family?
Yes. So John was exceptional in the fact that he took himself everywhere for the best opportunities of training.
Okay.
Coach Stephen used to take him to Manchester quite regularly. In fact, he went to Manchester for this camp as well. He trained up in my gym in Belfast. He went to the McGuigan's gym at one point for sparring in England, in London, and he travelled around wherever needed be to get the best to try and better himself. So, but he, as I say, when he was up here, he stayed with me, you know, in my home with my family, and he was as quiet as a mouse. Well behaved and from a great upbringing. You know, I had this chat with his mum, Tina, and I was saying, you know, how well brought up he's been. And, you know, she was delighted to hear that, because you never know what way your own behave when you're not there.
And Mark, was John aware of the dangers of the sport, especially at that level? You're not wearing headgear and...
Well, every fighter is aware of the dangers of boxing, and especially professional boxing. So John was with the British Boxing Board of Control, and he had a meeting with them, with the late Hugh Russell and John Gray, who is our area secretary, who is actually a retired neurosurgeon at the Royal Victoria Hospital. So John, they explained all the pitfalls to John, as they do every boxer, and the Boxing Union of Ireland also do the same. And so every boxer knows what they're signing for. But again, like, you've seen the frenzy in the media with this sad and tragic event. But the reason it's been so thrown out there is because it is a complete rarity. To say I'm 40 years in boxing, and, you know, it's the first that came to my door, you know, and I can't reiterate that enough. Whereas, just to become a professional fighter, you have to go through vigorous, you know, medical checks and tests, and they're regular. They're an annual, an annual thing. So,
and was there ever any previous indications with John? Did he have difficulty making the weight? He looked, in the most recent photographs, he looked fantastic.
We were in London boxing a few months ago in John's comeback fight, because he's been out for a while from the Katie Taylor show.
The hand injury.
In the Three Arena. And he fought at the weight division above at lightweight, and basically, like, he looked terrible on the scales that day, and that was like 6 pound heavier.
Yeah,
but this time he had used a nutritionist and done everything properly.
Okay,
he was in the shape of his life, and he actually came in a pound under the super featherweight limit. So, you know, he was in tremendous shape, and as I say, the pictures, you know, pictures don't lie, and he looked $1 million. And I have to commend, you know, John's dedication and his coach's dedication for getting into such tip-top shape. It's just, it's incredible. I mean, I was also the matchmaker of the show, so I made the fight, which was sanctioned for the British Boxing Board of Control, obviously Celtic title and an eliminator for the British title, which is a big, big title.
Yeah.
And both fighters were it was approved as a good 50-50 match. Okay. Both fighters had similar records, you know, similar age, similar experience, even in amateur terms, and what made for a great fight, and it was a great fight, you know.
Yeah. And have you spoken to Nathan Hells since?
Funny, because I spoke to Nathan.
It was the opponent, obviously.
Yes. So I spoke to Nathan Funny for the first time. I spoke to his team, but I spoke to Nathan this morning just to check in on him, because obviously it was the biggest night of his life also.
Yeah.
And he was obviously victorious, but he can't even bring himself to celebrate.
Of course not.
Because you know, which is obviously sad for him too, but he's completely shell-shocked and devastated. But John's family have actually contacted him. He was telling me
and
offered them their congratulations and telling him to fight, you know, to keep fighting. And funny, Nathan said to me today, which, as I say, is new news, if that makes sense, is going to fight on for John because he wants to feel like that John's, you know, his victory over John and John's life wasn't in vain, then he'll win that title and dedicate it to him, which is very, 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 very honourable.
And Mark, what about your own reaction? As you mentioned to me earlier, you knelt by his bedside, so you're obviously of a man of belief.
Yes.
How has it affected you?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm still on adrenaline mode because it's been a lot to deal with because I'm supporting John's family.
Yeah.
I'm supporting his coach. I'm supporting the British Boxing Board of Control. Everybody, like these people, like his coach, for example, these are all going to need some sort of support because they were on a daily basis. They were, you know, like regulars in John's life. You know, when I say I'm close, and I was, and we come up and we spent time together, it was a different type of time. It was, you know what I mean? I wasn't training him. I was growing with him, if that makes sense. And so these people all need help and support, you know.
And Mark, as you said, this brings up now arguments again about the safety of boxing. But how do you respond? And I'm conscious that you're still in mourning and you're grieving and trying to come to terms with this. But how do you respond?
Well, look, boxing is our country's number one sport for success. Mm-hmm. Many Olympic champions as Ireland had, you know, in the boxing. You know, how many lives has it saved? How many people has it kept off the streets?
Okay.
Away from drugs, alcohol. How many people, you know? So to answer your question, you know, like boxing saved more lives than it's destroyed. So I have to still support it as a brutal sport it is. It's a sport that I'm passionate about, the good that it brings. And everybody knows that, including yourselves.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, we know the moments of great enhancement and outpourings of great joy and fervour when our boxers win, be it in the three arena, the national stadium going back, or indeed in an Olympic forum. But in terms of, say, headgear, is that where does that argument at the minute, Mark?
Well, headgear is a false sense of security. You know, if you're driving a motorbike and you had a car, you know, it's not going to do too much. It's, you know, like what I'm saying is it will help. Yes, it'll help head injuries and all that. But head guards in boxing to me are only a false sense of security. And the reality is, if anything, the stop cuts. You know, maybe at some of the lower level, when young kids are young and training, whatever. Yes, but I really don't see what head guards can achieve. I think. Okay. I think the medical criteria for professional boxing alone is levels above most sports, because, as I say, with the amount of medicals, the boxers have to do regularly. Yeah, you know.
What about reducing the duration of a fight?
Well, they've done that. It's just like what I'm saying is, you see John's fight. John's fight wasn't a brutal fight. It was a competitive fight. Yeah. While John was losing the contest in the end, he was never out of it.
Yeah.
If you understand, he still had a chance. Now, what I'm saying is, like, reducing rounds and doing all that, you know, it's a championship. It's a sport. It's like they're trying to turn the Grand National into a 1 mile sprint or a 5 furlong sprint.
It doesn't work.
It is a dangerous contact sport. We all know that. But so is MMA. So is, you know, karate. Everything. You know, they're all carry their dangers.
So again, I come back to the effect it's had on you, Mark. You're obviously a different age group to young John, God rest him. Does it make you think again that, I don't know what the future holds for you? Obviously, you've been deeply affected by this.
Well, as I say, right now I'm still on the adrenaline of all this. And hopefully this is the last interview we'll have to do. Because every time... you know, you talk about it just brings up, you know, bad memories. But time is a great healer, and at one point I think I'll maybe not do it anymore. But then I think again back to the lives that it does save.
And I'm told as well, you when the book of condolence was opened, in the Ulster Hall, you were there talking to people, and that's your plan is to be there and talk to people, which is an amazing gesture. Has your religion helped you, Mark?
Well, I'm a believer in God, you know, if you look at like an atheist doesn't believe in God. So then there's no hope, because when you're dead or whatever. But if you, the one thing that God brings is hope. So we've always got hope. And that's a thing that we have.
Yeah. And was John himself religious, do you know? Or...
Well, you know, he believed in God equally too. And he went to church and, you know, I don't know how deep he was, but I know.
Yeah, well, let's hope that and the support of so many people like yourself will give you and Tina and his brothers, Connor, and Aaron and his fiance Emmeline will give them strength in the awful, awful, awful time ahead. Trying to come to terms with that. A man at the height of his skill, his prowess, his training.
I mean, this was his leaping, his big come out fight, which was like, you know, it performed on the Katie Taylor undercard. Yeah. It was fantastic. And then he picked up a small injury not long after that, and then he went away with Emmeline. They went to Australia for 6 months and decided to come back home. And it's just terrible. It's just traumatic, and it's terrible for even Emmeline now having to think about the rest of her life without John, a future that they had big plans for.
Well, Mark, condolences again, and to you and Tina, and say to Huey, his father, Tina's mother, Connor and Aaron, his siblings, Stephen O'Rourke, I'm conscious of as well. Conscious of Nathan Howells, the young man that was in the ring with him, conscious of all the people and all his friends and everyone in the boxing community. I know how strong a community it is. So we'll all those of us who pray will say a prayer, and we'll say a prayer that John is safe and will rest in peace, safe in the arms of Our Lady, Queen of Heaven. God rest that young man. God rest John Clooney.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye.
Noreen, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good. How are you? You feel 58, which is very young. Very young. You're convinced it's your age is against you when it comes looking for a job.
Well, I think so, yeah. I can't think of anything else but it might be, Joe, you know.
And what has been your employment record and how come it's come to a shuddering halt?
Well, my last position was on an agency contract. And at the end of 2023, none of the contracts were renewed.
Okay.
So that just left me unemployed. And ever since then, well, I kind of knew it was happening in September 2023. So I started looking for another position then, and as of yet, I cannot find one.
And how long had you been doing that job?
I was doing it sort of going on contract from one place to another. So since 2020, I started in the COVID testing centre and kind of went on other contracts as a result of that into admin roles and reception.
And you say, I'm 58 and I feel lonely and isolated because of this, and you feel that there is ageism.
But surely, I think it's very surely much alive and kicking.
Yeah, sure, but do people not take on board 58, which again I say is young, brings experience and wisdom and maturity and dignity and everything that comes with that.
Well, it does, Joe, but I'm afraid it doesn't. It's not what they're looking for.
So
I live in Limerick, and there aren't that. There are jobs, of course there are. There's a wide variety of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just not everyone, you just don't get them. It's as simple as that.
And are you given a reason? Or do you have to be given a reason for that?
No, there are some interviews that I've gone for, and the employer would say to you, well, we'll be making our mind up, we'll say by Friday.
Mm.
So you're expecting to hear by Friday, and then you just don't hear. And on one occasion, I contacted the employer, and I just said, I haven't heard from you. Could I get an update?
Well,
and they said, oh, I thought, and her answer to me was, I thought you knew. If you didn't hear from us, well, that means you didn't get it.
Oh.
Which I thought was...
Yeah, well, maybe that's an angle that employers should be looking at. They're so blasé. I mean, to apply for a job, get an interview for a job is a big, big milestone, and then you've to if you don't hear anything, you've heard nothing and you've got nothing. That's their line.
That's the bottom line, yes.
Now, have you seen the age group of other people going for the same interviews?
Well, you know, it's not really, no. I mean, unless you go into the premises afterwards and, you know, try to see the person who got the position, but do I want to spend my time doing that? No, I don't. The fact of the matter is I could spend an hour on the line to you telling you about my experiences and it will just be repeated all over the country. The fact of the matter is that it needs to be acknowledged there is age discrimination in the workplace and in employing older adults.
But like,
that needs to be acknowledged.
It doesn't affect you because of the age. But like, there's ads everywhere in the last few weeks from An Gardaí saying the age limit is now 50, which is wonderful, in the Garda Síochána. So the states seem to be moving, but the jobs you're
just
looking for...
Okay. Quick enough for me, really, is this?
So how do you react when you get another knockback?
Well, at this point, I'm running out of jobs to apply for, to be quite honest, because I've applied for so many, it's untrue. I'm not in a position to really get up and emigrate at 58, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So what does that leave you with?
You did an honours degree when you were 40, which is fantastic. And you did that why?
Because I was finishing rearing my family and I had a diploma in social studies, and I just decided I would get the degree and see would improve my chances. And well,
and did it?
I mean, it has helped me out. It has assisted me in other jobs I've done up to this. I have used that, but not now. No, I don't see. I feel completely hopeless. I feel completely invisible. I've applied for jobs, and I'm shocked to see the carry on. And who actually got the job in the end of the day? And I can tell you, there weren't 58. I can tell you that.
What are you saying? They were half that age.
A lot younger, and it is definitely a problem. And I just decided to reach out to you there, Joe, because I thought I just don't know what to do.
And how do you survive, Noreen, financially?
Well, my savings is just dwindling away, and what can you do? You just go through each day and you just keep going, keep trying to find something, but I just don't seem to be getting very far. It's as simple as that.
And have you savings?
Well, what savings I had from while I was working, but as I said, it's dwindling pretty quick in just paying basic living expenses and that kind of thing, you know?
And are you entitled on your, well, obviously not free travel. I presume the fuel allowance, because of your age, doesn't kick in either.
No, and if you're not long-term unemployed, you don't get fuel allowances, you don't get Christmas bonuses, so on and so forth. You're not entitled to any of that. Not that my ambition is to be long-term unemployed.
Difficult. Is this the longest period, the longest duration?
Well, it is, and that's what's worrying me, because it doesn't seem to be ending. I can't see a way out of it. I really can't.
Have you spoken to anyone else in this same position, or indeed a professional who you might say might sit down and say, can I improve my CV? Can I come at it from a different angle?
Look, I have done all of that, and there's all those services within Intro, within other organisations. There's a whole load of duplication of those services. I've had my CV revamped and all that kind of business, and attended for Intro for my personal progression plan, and sure, it's just you go in, you tick a few boxes, and you get up and leave again. Actually, we'll see you again in 6 weeks' time.
And that's been going on for what, over a year, obviously, isn't it?
Yeah, I am unemployed since the 31st of December 2023, and that's the length of time I have been unemployed, and it's awful.
And how do you pass your day? You've obviously got a lot of energy and interest.
Well,
and creative.
I just try to keep myself as busy as I can. Yeah. But, I mean, there's only so much you can do. You're trying to watch money, not spend it.
Yeah, yeah.
And try to spare it on your living expenses, never mind going out and going somewhere, doing something. So there is very, very, you're just limited all the way around.
And
but I would like to push the idea of the acknowledgement of discrimination for older adults, because it simply isn't acknowledged. Every other group is acknowledged, which they should be, and included, but you won't see an ad or you won't see a poster in any Intro office or on any social media talking about, and this is from the government's perspective now, I'm not just talking about from any individual, on discrimination against older adults in the workplace. You just won't see it. It's not acknowledged.
So how would
and I feel that that's the problem.
How would you describe then your response to it? Is it demoralisation? Is it anger? Is it?
Well, I feel a bit of both, really, because I feel, well, what do I do? I'm 58 years of age. I'm healthy. I'm not. I don't have any illnesses. I don't take medication for anything. I'm completely healthy. Ready and willing and capable of going to work, I'm afraid it isn't there for me. I'd love to just go around and video record it.
And what about people who say, well, there's no groups you can get involved with, or
I did get involved with a volunteer group there, and I do volunteer as I am.
Oh, well done.
But you could get involved with women's groups, and I did, and I met up with a lovely group of women. But again, there's a lot of expense involved in it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had to kind of step away from it, because I thought, I can't commit, and then if you're constantly turning down the invitations, well, obviously they think, well, there's something wrong. Doesn't she like us or something?
But I think that's a very good point. Volunteering does cost money. I know it's brilliant, but it does cost money. And there's no
bit of volunteering I do. It doesn't really.
I'm thinking of travel. Even if you had the free travel, which you don't, because of that limbo you're in, that age group you find yourself in, which is terrible. You're well qualified for a job, just because our Taoiseach and up to recently and now our Tánaiste, Simon, is only in his 30s. That makes the rest of us at times feel old. But anyway, would you move to a different area, Noreen?
I would, if the opportunity was there. I would, within Ireland, yes, I would. If the opportunity was there and the job was there for me, absolutely.
Okay, 51551 joe@rt.ie. Anne, you're listening to Noreen.
Hello there, how are you?
Off you go, Anne. You want to talk to Noreen?
I did. Noreen, first of all, I work in the HR space, right, for a multinational company. And I totally understand the perception that you have in terms of what your experience is. And what I wanted to say to you was, I just wanted to give you an inside view of when we get CVs in and we scan through the CVs. The majority of CVs these days don't have date of birth on it. But, you know, you'd have a good idea from looking down through how many years experience and the education and all of that, right? And what we're looking for is, we're looking for the keywords that match the job description that you've applied for, right? So if I'm hiring for, you know, a caterer, I'm going to be looking for the key skills associated with the catering. And I just wanted to bring up the point that, you know, there is a perception out there that if you're in different age groups that you can be discriminated against, and I don't take that away from anybody. But what I would say is, I've examined generations in the workplace, right, as part of a research topic for my studies.
Okay.
And there was no data to support that, you know, generational differences exist, but rather a perception of how you're treated, okay? And the point I want to make in that is that in our industry, we have people who've been with the company for 40 years who would be considered really wise, really experienced people, and they bring with them so many wonderful, warm skills that they then share with, let's say, the younger generation coming into the workplace. And I think it's up to an employer to take a duty of care to, you know, foster cross-collaboration between the younger people coming in and, you know, the more mature team members that they have, so that, you know, we have all sorts of diversity within the workplace, because that fosters innovation. And I have no doubt that if you have a tailored approach to your CV for each of the jobs you apply for, and if you get a little bit of coaching, I know you mentioned you had some support around how to address interview questions. YouTube has wonderful videos from different coaches on how to address that, and really just, you know, customise and take the time to customise to each of the jobs. You know, the job market is hard. It's very hard. Yeah. Employers don't contact everyone who's unsuccessful at being shortlisted because they don't have the bandwidth to do it. Common sense would say, you know, for your brand, you should reach out and say thank you at least, but they have automation now to do that on their behalf. But I would be strongly encouraging you to maybe have a chat with a careers coach and somebody that you get on with and you can connect with and can speak to on a human level and can value and look at what your worth is. Final point, there is a course on LinkedIn, a fixed versus a growth mindset, okay? How you come out of being in that space of, you know, nobody wants to hire me, I feel unhireable. I have no doubt that you have incredible skills and talents. You just need to find the right fit for you. And that works both ways. It's not just on you satisfying an employer. An employer also has to satisfy your needs. So I would encourage you to look at that fixed versus growth mindset, LinkedIn Learning, and I wish you the very best of luck.
And Anne, does Noreen have to put her date of birth on the CV?
No, there's no legal requirement to do that.
Okay. Well, would you consider removing that, Anne, Noreen?
I don't put my date of birth on the...
It's when the interview happens, yeah.
I don't do it. I think it's quite obvious from my experience. Now, I don't list every job going back to when I first started work. There's no point. And I do... I apply for jobs that I am qualified and experienced in doing. If I'm going to apply for something that maybe, you know, no, they wouldn't be interested in hearing about your social care degree, I just take it away. Okay? Because I've been asked by... a recruitment agency, if you take that off, maybe it'll improve your chances. And that's fact. I don't go in with an attitude of, oh my God, I'm not going to get this because I am older. I don't ever go into a job like that. I walk in that door very confidently. And I know from my experience, and I appreciate this lady, you know, you have your perspective and view on the world and how things happen, but I know from experience what I am up against.
John is on the line. Stay with us, Noreen. John in Navan. John, you're listening.
Joe, good afternoon to you.
Do you agree? Do you agree with Noreen?
Agree. I'll just give you my. I do. Yeah, indeed. But I'll tell you, Joe. The problem here is ageism, and they can package it up any way they like. But that is the problem. Just before I go any further, taking off your date of birth of your CV is no point. There's no point in that because you're only going to go to the trouble then of travelling to an interview and then they'll find out you're 58 or 63. But Joe, I don't. Sorry, I just said to your colleagues there, I don't actually need a job. I'm comfortable enough and I'm doing it, doing bits and pieces. But just for the laugh over the last few years, post-COVID, I said, you know, these job sites, I won't name them obviously because they're all one or another. Apply for jobs, and out of about 30 to 35, Joe, I had one reply.
Wow.
So I consider myself very, very skilled in the hospitality industry. I was in it for 35 years, went to the very top hotels in Dublin that you would know yourself. But I think the stumbling block is the DOB, and nobody will tell me anything else.
Would you ever say it? How does that get you anywhere?
As I said, out of 35-ish applications, one company has replied to me. And again, I won't name the company, in fairness, but like they're one that everybody gives out about, you know. But I was amazed that they were the only one that replied to me, you know. But it's ageism, Joe. It's pure and simple. And that's the holy all of it. Like, you know, and it's a sad state of affairs because, like your contributors there, like, we have an abundance of knowledge in our heads.
Yeah,
and
course,
it's all going to waste. It's going to waste, you know? So, I don't know. I feel for that woman there, that lady, you know, and I can't see. Maybe I'm wrong. Hopefully after this, somebody will contact her yourselves. But that's the stumbling block. It's our age, unfortunately. That's it.
Noreen, would you consider applying for other jobs? But again, I can hear the cul-de-sac in my voice.
Well, no, yeah, I have. That's kind of, I'm just going to have to basically lower my expectations. It's as simple as that. And just see, can I find anything, even if it's in a shop or whatever, you know, and just find something, because not doing anything every day, not having a focus, not having a structure.
Yeah.
It's just, I find it too much. It's mind-blowing to me how anyone does this 7 days of the week. I find it excruciating. It's a nightmare, it really is.
Okay.
So, but look.
We had people on a few weeks ago about their hobbies. Do you have hobbies or...
I do a little bit of like flower arranging, and I cycle and
Joe,
that
that's okay
stuff
for the weekends.
Yeah, I know what you mean, John. Yeah. I know what you mean.
Can't do it 7 days in a week.
And your lady needs a job. I can hit you. Come on.
I know. And your point is, John, you get a better kick out of your hobby when you have
been doing
other stuff all week. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, hopefully it'll work out okay in the end, but it's an uphill battle for us all, unfortunately. I don't know, after 51 or 2 or 3, they start raising the eyebrows, you know.
Say listen to Sean O'Doherty, and thanks for checking me on that, John. You're dead right. Hobbies come in a... No, they do. They come in a context. They do come in a context. Sean O'Doherty, Sean. You're listening to John, Anne and Noreen. Go ahead, Sean.
How you doing, Joe?
Yeah,
I just want to try and give her a little bit of hope. I had been working and I was in and out of jobs. And then when I was 64, I thought I was retired. And I had no job seekers. That had run out. So I felt I'm not really ready for this retirement thing. So I seen the job for a teaching position in Clondalkin.
Okay.
And I went for it. And I'm working away in Clondalkin Community College at the moment.
Well done.
You know?
Well done.
So... So that's all. I just need to say that I And I always worried about ageism in recruitment, that would I, you know, well, it gets harder, you know, but if you keep plugging away and have faith in your abilities and your experiences and qualifications, I do believe something does come up. Something, I know that sounds very smug and very kind of, anybody can do it. And I know sometimes that's not the case, but she just keeps plugging away. She will get a position that suits her, and she will find someone who wants her in their job, if you know what I mean.
And Noreen is obviously plugging away because she contacted us, which I which I appreciate, Noreen, as I do the responses from Anne, John, and Sean. Thanks indeed, Noreen. I suppose the best words are there from Sean. Keep the faith. John saying maybe, you know, might only be a phone call away, but keep up the contact. Joe at RT.ie. Paddy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. What happened? You went, was it last Friday?
No, I'll tell you what it is, actually. I'm a senior citizen, and anyone over 70 years of age has to get a medical report to get their driving license. So my driving license, expired. It's expiring next Monday, the 18th. And I went down and brought the form down to the doctor to get the doctor to fill in the form. Okay. It has to be done in the presence of a doctor, and I had to sign it in his presence. And I came back, when I was finished, I came back out then to receptionist to pay, and the girl says to me, that'll be €60.
Okay.
And I said, €60? She replied, yes. I said, I was here 3 years ago in 2022, and I got the same form filled in, and I only paid €30. And when did it go to 60?
Yeah,
and she says to me, it's gone to 60 a long time. Say, so that's a crease of 100%. I says, that's outrageous. And she just turned around very flippantly in her own little way. And she turned around and she says to me, you're getting a free license. And sure, it's only going to cost you, the €60 is only going to cost you an average of €20 per year for the next 3 years. But I says, that's not the point. I paid €30, I said, in 2022 when I went to get my form. And in 2019, when I went to get the form the first time, when I reached the 70-year mark, I only paid 20. So I went up 50% on the, from the 219.
It's been 100.
Yeah, and it's gone up 100% now. And the only reason I sent in the email to you was, I was just wondering, is that a standard practice throughout the country? Was this set by the Medical Council or the RSA or even by the NLDS, you know?
And you have a medical card at your age,
Oh,
Maddie.
Yeah, well, I know it's not covered on the medical card. Okay, yeah, I know it's not covered. I understand that, and I knew that.
What does the protocol involve? You fill out the form before you go into the medic.
No, I just fill out my name and address on the form, and the doctor fills in the second part.
Which is, does he have to put you up in a trolley?
He didn't give me any medical exam because I've been attending the doctor for the last 30 years, and all my medical files is there. I suffer like most of the country, as I said, with high blood pressure, you know. And he's said to me, he says, you're a fit-looking man. He says, and all I'm going to do is tick the form. And he says, I'm going to sanction you for another 3 years, you know.
And that took how long?
I don't mind paying the €30, but I think the €60 is very, very stiff, you know. And it is very, very stiff.
Paddy, how long did this protocol take?
It only took about 5-6 minutes, I'd say. That's about all, you know.
It's a bit flippant of the staff member to say, hey, you're nothing to do with her or him or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You're getting a free license because you're over 70.
Yeah.
The cert covers 3 years. That works at 20. Yeah, God, that's very good of them, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's about 360, between 360 and 380,000 people over 70 drivers in this country. And we say they all get their free driving license. It costs the government about 24 million. So that's on average 8 million per year, you know? So I was just thinking, I mean, if the government, I think that they should subsidize this payment to the doctors of somewhere in the region of €30. I don't mind paying €30.
Your other question, I think, is a fair question as well, Paddy. How much is it generally? Do they have to, do doctors, or indeed pharmacies, have to put up a sign saying the cost of dispensing or the cost of writing or filling in for your driver's license is X, the cost of filling in a sick cert is X, the cost of giving you prescription drugs over the counter in a chemist's, because we know the pharmacists obviously get paid and they should be paid. Yeah. But is there any transparency in those figures?
Yeah, no. But the amazing thing, Joe, about it is that if I had went in to my doctor and he sanctioned me for 1 year, we'd say a driving license for 1 year, I'd pay the €60, and I'd have to pay, if I wanted the next year when my application would come up again, it would be another €60, you know. I mean, it's very hard on some old senior citizens. I mean, it's not easy to come up with €60 if in one way, you know.
Of course, yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing about it, I had no objection whatsoever to paying €30. And I mean, I paid it for, as I said, the last time, and I've had 20.
But you're interested, as I am, in hearing, is that the norm now? What is the norm?
I wonder, I think that might have been sanctioned by the Medical Council of Ireland, I think, somehow or another. I don't know.
But I thought that I thought they can't cooperate in terms of fees because doctors are all invariably sole traders, and you can't.
Yeah, or is it an independent price by the colleague, by the doctors?
Yeah, no. Can you? You're right. Can you go onto a website and be told actually you should be paying X for HRT prescription, B for a cert for your driving license, C for a six cert?
Yeah. I just taught myself, in my own little mind, it's a little bit Irish, as we say, you know.
You're right. And by the way, it's a quarter of a pension, isn't it? Of a weekly pension.
Yeah, it is, exactly. Yeah, That's the point about it, you know what I mean? Yeah. And, but the receptionist now was kind of, she annoyed me the way she said it, very flippantly, you know.
Come here, Paddy, you had great courage bringing it up. I just think people don't say it. People in Ireland don't send awful food back. They don't send cold food back. They don't generally give out about prices. So how should we the highest electricity prices in all of Europe?
Yeah.
And nobody gives out about, well, they are now. But that's been known. I've said it on this programme for years.
Yeah.
Anyway,
no, but I just said,
I think, could anyone else hear you, Paddy?
Could anyone else? There was no one there at the
reception.
Yeah, there was no one there. I was just there on my own, actually, because you go to the doctor and you get the exam, and he says to you, go back down to reception now, because they put the medical stamp on the reception.
Course,
and the girl says
you need
to me,
that,
that'll be €60 now. And I looked, I was gobsmacked.
Yeah,
I said, 60.
You're lucky you didn't have to say to her, listen, I'm falling into a weakness, can I go back into the doctor? She would have charged you another 60.
Yeah, it's a lot of money now to be paying out to put his name on the.
Well, let's
form,
hear from
you know?
People. Joe at RT.ie, how much do you pay when you go to your GP? Or do you know how much you pay in a pharmacy for a prescription charge? And should those figures be more transparent? Paddy, good to meet them all. Good. Well done, Paddy.
Thank you very
keep
much.
Going. Keep going. Keep motoring. Joe at RT.ie. Back to the 126, this incredible situation that's been uncovered. St. Patrick's Guild, it was an adoption agency, and it was discovered that they illegally registered babies. In other words, on the birth cert, instead of the names of the adoptive parents and the real name of the birth parent, the adoptive parents were put down as the birth parents and the natural parents were ignored. Tina, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe?
Good. When did you discover this, Tina, that your lived name for 63 years was not your name?
On the 15th, Wednesday the 15th of January 2019.
And how did you discover?
I received a letter from TUSLA, a registered letter.
Yeah.
And I had been a preschool teacher in a primary school for boys. I had been a cub leader, and at the time I was working on transport from a special needs school. And of course, straight away came into my head child protection.
Okay, my God.
And I rang the number and was told it wasn't child protection, that it was something about my birth cert.
Okay.
And they would get back. And I got out my birth cert and I was looking at it and couldn't see anything. Mm-hmm. And
the names of your mother and father.
My parents, my mother and father. I can't call them social parents, my mother and father.
Yes, of course.
there and occupation and all that. And I knew I was born in a private nursing home in Dublin.
Yeah.
I knew that. And the 25th of December 1956, my claim to fame, born on Christmas Day. Used to always say, I'd like to die on a Good Friday. There's a thing to have on a headstone.
Okay.
And that's gone.
Yeah.
Because it's the 14th of December and they're not, they can't find any proof of where I was born.
Wow.
I don't even know if I was born in the private nursing home.
And when the two social workers travelled over to meet you...
No, I'm in...
Oh, you're okay. Okay.
I'm in local, I'm in Waterford.
Okay, so you...
And sorry to backtrack.
No, go on, no problem.
Yeah, so my son's partner was here that day and went home and told my son, who remembered watching the minister announce it on the news that there was 126 people who didn't know that they were adopted. We weren't adopted. We were legally registered. So when the social worker rang the next day to make an appointment for the following week, I said, my son has red flags flying here. And the social worker said, hold on. And he came back and said, I'll meet you in the adoption rooms of Tewsla in Waterford. So I knew then that what my son had read on the Irish Times and had seen on the television in 2016, but he didn't. I mean, why would he? Wouldn't have entered his head, because it never entered my head that I was not who I am.
Yeah.
And
did you ever hear, Tina, when you were growing up,
because
you believed your mother was your birth mother. That's what the documentation says.
Yes, and my father. Yes. I think I look like my father.
Yeah.
I went around to family. I was very lucky. I have cousins who are in their 90s.
Okay.
And they said, couldn't believe, no. They said, no, there wasn't not one hint, not one rumour, not one nothing.
Wow.
They came down from Dublin with the baby. That was me. And everyone celebrated. And nobody... And I nursed my mother in latter years with dementia.
Okay.
And not one... This... It is... For anybody who thought they were adopted or who... It's mind-boggling. You live with it every day. And now, because of our beloved friend Susan, now we live in the fear that we're going to die.
Yeah.
And our children are going to have what, Lisa? I mean,
and Tina, when you spoke to your cousins,
yes,
and Lisa's brilliant. But when you spoke to your cousins, did any of them even remember your mother, i.e., the name of the woman on the birth cert? Did anyone even remember her being pregnant? Which she obviously wasn't.
My cousin told me she's 93. She got married October 55.
Yeah.
And my mother was at my wedding and they all embraced her stomach. They patted her belly. So I have a vision now of my mother with a cushion down it. People do not realise what goes through our minds.
God.
To think that your mother was at a wedding with a cushion or whatever falls, or I don't know. I mean, we're going back to the 50s, and I understand it must have been horrific for young girls to be pregnant.
Yes, yes.
I really do, and it's so great that we've moved on, but this is what we live with, because our whole identity was taken away.
So, Tina, who are you now to who? Do you follow me? Because there's confusion between... the two departments about whose job it is to change, to correct. Not to change. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't done accidentally. No. It was done deliberately.
Yes.
Your birth mother was deliberately left off your birth certificate and another name was put on as your birth mother, which was illegal, obviously.
Yes.
But your lived-in name, as people were calling it, for the last, 65, 66 years?
Well, I'm 68 now, 68, I think. I forget.
Tina, they even took your Christmas Day away.
did it, took that away, you know. And I understand that, well, my parents, or social parents, must have been terrified I'd be taken back. They must have wanted a baby so much and must have been terrified. I understand that. I hope that they did live with me while I was baby and grown up in peace. They seemed to. We had a lovely, lovely childhood. Yeah. But I feel now, and I feel wherever they are, I hope they're not churning like I'm churning, like we are churning when you go to the doctor. Well, your date of birth. Yeah. Everything. If you go to a consultant, like everybody has a password. The password seems to be our date of birth, and our date of birth is wrong. It's not the day we were born on.
You see, we asked the Department of Social Welfare, is there, because they said they would change this and correct it. And as I say, corrected is probably the wrong word, because correction implies mistake. But it wasn't a mistake, it was deliberate. Is there a codicil linking these two records together? There is an index to link the records. The index is not publicly available under the legislation. And we were told yesterday about this, form 3B. 3B or not 3B? Have you come across 3B, Tina?
3B and 2B are not to be. I have to say, we are a beautiful... On, as I said, social family, biological family, but I have a family now, who am I family? Mm. And I'm not stupid. I find some things very, when you're looking at all that, you're looking at that bill and this bill and that bill, and they would put it in simple English for me. But at the moment, I have taken a little leave of absence from it because it got so much for me. Okay. And I just wanted to give my family and my husband a little bit of peace of me trying to be the normal Tina that I was before all this happened. So,
Tina, does this mean that your birth mother, whose name isn't on your birth cert, that she couldn't find you if she went looking for you?
Well, she knows about me now.
Does she? Okay.
But if she had, yes, she won't answer. And I understand that. She has a life to live. I did. I met my birth father.
Okay.
And my half siblings from Leitrim. Now, there you are. So I thought I came from Waterford, but I didn't. Yeah. I came from Leitrim, beautiful country.
Beautiful county.
Yeah. You know.
Okay, Tina, it's just that confusion that...
Yes.
And it's relatively few people, but it affects them 100%, if not more, as you've so articulately said what it means to people, that your lived-in name, and indeed your lived-in date of birth, you discover in your late 60s, in your case your early 60s, that it's all untrue.
Yeah.
And it was collusion by the state.
And by the religious orders.
Yeah, and then, as we heard yesterday, when it was taken to court, it was a slap on the wrist.
Yes.
And then the pain it causes down to the decades.
Okay. And it's going to live on because I have four children and I have grandchildren. Yeah.
Okay, Tina, it's wonderful to hear from you. So sorry under these circumstances, but kind regards to you and your extended family. That's Tina. joe@rt.ie. Went up, what, nearly 100% for Paddy. Margaret, how much did you pay to have your cert signed by the medic?
Euro.
Oh, wow.
€100.
For the same service, just to have your...
Yes, form filled in.
How long did it take?
About 3 minutes.
Wow. And do you remember what it was before that? Or was that your first time to have it done?
Oh, no, indeed, it wasn't my first time. It was 55.
Okay.
Because I remember thinking to myself, this is twice the amount. If I wasn't a pensioner, I'm paying twice the amount for my driving licence.
And your pension hasn't doubled?
No.
£100.
So I just was aghast.
And is there a sign in reception saying these are our charges?
No.
So obviously they're not obliged to have a sign.
I didn't see it.
Yeah, of course.
Pardon?
They're obviously not obliged to. They should be, but they're not. And I know they do great work, and the staff do great work, and they're busy.
Oh, yes, they certainly do.
Can be difficult,
do,
but 100 quid.
Yeah, well, I just thought it was an extraordinary amount to pay for a pensioner. Now, I'm not saying that I couldn't afford it. I could. But that's not the point.
It's not the point, exactly.
You know, because the point about it was that you're made to think that, you know, you're getting, because you're a pensioner, you're paying less for your driving license. But in fact, I was paying twice the amount.
Because they're making up. And I presume, I don't know if you recall the actual day, but I presume they didn't say to you, oh, well, you're getting your driver, as you said to Paddy, you're getting your driver license for nothing.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. Well, they said it to Paddy, but they said it to the wrong man.
Yes.
They said it
to
the
well,
wrong man.
I can assure you, had they said it to me, they would have said it to the wrong woman too.
Well done. Well done, Margaret. Well done.
Yeah.
Okay, well, safe travelling, Margaret. Well, but 100 quid now, just to get your...
Your form signed for your driving license.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Is Rita there? No, okay. Dawn, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Back to, you're the same age as Noreen at the start of the programme.
Yeah, I am.
And have you the same experience of finding it difficult at 58 to get a job?
I think our experiences, the parallels between our experiences were what prompted me to get in touch with you, yeah.
So you've loads of experience, as Noreen had, and how long have you been looking for a job?
My last job ended in end of May last year, and I've sporadically been self-employed to be able to sort of pick up the slack between getting a full-time job and trying to have some flexibility in terms of looking, but it just feels like a wasteland out there in terms of the level of response that I don't get is more frightening to me than, you know, the responses that I do get that are just spurned out by, you know.
And do you put your date of birth on
never.
But as someone said, they see it, when you get there.
Well, of course. When you've got, when you have 30 some odd years experience, and when you have advanced degrees and, you know, capabilities that are easily identifiable, this is something that is obviously going to speak to your age. And particularly because women women struggle more so than men. Many women become almost invisible in the workplace over the age of 50. And then they, as a result, in my experience, we almost get subjected to, you know, verbal abuse and sort of toxicity in the workplace as a direct result, because we're viewed as being invisible and of no value. That's what it feels like.
And then the Trump scenario, that DEI is now a dirty word.
Yeah, it's just pure prejudice, right? It's a mindset of acceptability to dismiss people from, you know, who are older or who are women or who are of color or of a certain ethnicity. Like, it's just, to me, it's a breakdown in DEI globally is perpetuated by a political landscape and by public agendas that influence decisions by corporations. Like, just this morning, I was reading about Accenture in the United States, who is run by a woman, and they've just abolished their entire DEI.
And I saw there's a one opinion poll. I'm not up to speed in Accenture, that have a great record in this country. But there's one opinion poll yesterday which said something like 44% of the population agreed with Trump's turning DEI into a dirty word. Diversity, equity and inclusion. He turned it into a dirty word overnight. A pejorative.
I kind of look at it this way. You can poll people after the fact because they're easily influenced by, and no reflection on you whatsoever, but by the media and what the media tells them. So if you hear the diatribe over and over and over again that DEI is bad, eventually you're going to be able to convince 44% of the people that DEI is bad.
Wow.
Like, that's not going to be difficult to do. It's almost like a game.
Okay.
But in terms of, you know, experienced, with, you know, people who are over the age of 50, who have 25, 30 years experience and are being purposely excluded from the workforce, when we know that the workforce is aged, the majority of people who are going to be working, you know, are going to be over 50.
Yeah, like, it's a no-brainer.
We're going to need people to keep the economy going. People. And I just don't understand.
I'm just looking at the calls here, Don. It's a bigger issue than I think a lot of people thought it was. Thanks indeed, Don. Let me go back to Rita. Yeah. Then to Paul. Rita, your medical for your driving license, how much?
€65 for myself and my husband on the same day.
130 euro.
Yes.
And they won't give you a reduction even, too, for the...
Most of all, not at all. Your class is an individual.
Yeah, I know the argument they'll use,
Yeah.
Buy one, get one free. and it's, do you remember what it was the last time?
€50.
So it's gone up, it just flies up and there's no... It's because people, because it's different, it seems, in every surgery and people don't...
That's right.
There's no national figures. And then when, if the pint goes up 4 pence, Rita, the country comes to a standstill.
That's right.
Every newspaper in the country is the lead story. Mm-hmm. Shock, horror.
Yeah.
Okay, mind you,
there
best...
Be
yeah, here, here. There should be a set rate. Yes, Rita, of course it should.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rita. Safe travelling, Rita and her husband. Paul Mulvey, to finish, you're retired. You're still very young. What do you think about Nori and indeed lots of other... Don was saying that... What did Don say at one stage in our it texted me saying that she has no hope in hell of getting a job at 58.
No, and that wouldn't surprise me, Joe, because if you walk into an interview and you're speaking to a HR manager that's half your age and you've got all these years of experience behind you, that HR manager may be intimidated by you. And they might be much more comfortable with a 23-year-old graduate who they can manipulate and be more malleable. A retired person could be seen as inflexible rather than valuable. For me, I was in the workforce for 42 years. I'm 8 years retired. Mm-hmm. I'm PAYE now for 51 years. But I would like to be able to work in industry because I have lots more in the tank, the same as yourself, Joe. And I would like to be able to work in industry, not 9 to 5, not 5 days a week, but in a particular combination of ways that suit me. On the other side of the equation, industry has occasional requirements where they need people for certain tasks for short term and they don't want to employ people full time. So there needs to be some sort of glue in between the two, a matchmaking function that can match the resource of the likes of me and all the people, the fresh people of my age, with industry requirements, and simply to tap into that resource. But there's a problem. As I said, I'm on PAYE for 51 years now. If I work for a company, I'll pay tax on that. And I really don't have to pay. And if somebody else says, I have done the state some service at this stage, so I don't want to pay any more tax.
You have lots more tiger in the tank,
But what I would like is if there was a facility where if a company employed me to do something, we could transfer the gross wage being offered to a charity of my choice.
Okay, there's loads of angles on it, loads of incentives. Okay, Paul, go to Mila Morgan. I'm over time, unfortunately. That's Paul Mulvey in Athlone, Niall McMonagall on sound, Mary Elizabeth Bruton's broadcast coordinator, producer Rachel Graham. Ray Darcy's next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Cozy up with the new arrivals, in-store or online at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.